9 news in your head?
Arrested 9 people over the beheading of a teacher near his school in a Paris suburb, a judicial source said on Saturday. French President Emmanuel Macron has labeled the killing an Islamist terror attack. The source said the killing was carried out by an 18-year-old Chechen who was then shot and killed by police near the scene northwest of Paris. Members of his family were among those police detained for questioning. Police said the victim was 47-year-old history teacher Samuel Paty, who had shown his pupils cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad as part of a class discussion on freedom of expression, a lesson that had prompted complaints from parents. The attack came as a trial is in progress over the January 2015 massacre at the offices of the Charles Hebdo satirical magazine, which had published caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad that unleashed a wave of anger across the Islamic world. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman discussed energy markets and the implementation of agreements by the oil producers group known as OPEC Plus. This, the Kremlin said in a statement on Saturday. The statement also said that both sides have reiterated their willingness to continue close coordination in this area in order to maintain stability on the global energy market. Two leaders also discussed cooperation in combating the spread of coronavirus infections and the prospect of using a Russian vaccine in Saudi Arabia. Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan said Saturday that Turkey had raised the estimated reserves in a gas field off its Black Sea coast to 405 billion cubic meters after finding an additional 85 billion cubic meters. This is Turkey's biggest natural gas discovery. This is VOA News. Lebanon marks the first anniversary on Saturday of a non-sectarian protest movement that has rocked the political elite but has yet to achieve its goal of sweeping reform. 3 prime ministers have resigned since the movement started, but the country's barons, many of them warlords from the 1975-1990 civil war, remain firmly in power despite international and domestic pressure for change. Demonstrators plan to march from the main Beirut protest camp towards the port, the site of a devastating August 4th explosion, which has been widely blamed on the alleged corruption and incompetence of the hereditary elite. They will hold a candlelight vigil near Ground Zero at the precise time when a huge stockpile of ammonium nitrate fertilizer exploded, killing more than 200 people and devastating large parts of the capital. And in news related to the coronavirus pandemic, countries including Germany, Austria, Poland, Ukraine, and the Czech Republic reported record daily increases in the number of coronavirus infections. Austria's foreign minister has tested positive for the coronavirus and might have caught it at a meeting with his European counterparts on Monday, a spokeswoman for his ministry said. A man living in the same Vatican residence as Pope Francis has tested positive for COVID-19 and gone into isolation, the Vatican said. Australia's coronavirus hotspot of Victoria recorded a single case on Saturday, the lowest daily number since early June, and no deaths, with the state's top health official calling the figures wonderful, spelled O-N-E for the one. The Russian Direct Investment Fund and Dr. Reddy's Laboratories have received renewed approval to conduct late-stage clinical trials in India of the Russian COVID-19 vaccine, the Sovereign Wealth Fund said on Saturday. Pfizer said it could file in late November for U.S. authorization of the COVID-19 vaccine it is developing, suggesting that a vaccine could potentially be available in the country by the end of the year. And the World Health Organization said it would assess monoclonal antibodies and other antiviral drugs in its trial of potential COVID-19 treatments after the trial found Gilead Sciences' remdesivir had no impact on survival rates. And thousands of Thai democracy protesters massed in multiple locations across Bangkok Saturday, defying an emergency decree banning gatherings for the 3rd consecutive day. For more on these and other international stories, please visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Laurel Berman for VOA News.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Democratic space has been narrowed. Fundamental liberty have been confiscated, and repression have increased in intensity. This is the situation that we are currently facing in this country.
Guineans go to the polls to choose a new president Sunday.
We might have a situation on our hands where this protest will continue, because these people we see on the streets, they seem very determined and they want to pull through. And they keep saying that what they have gotten from the government so far is too little. They want more.
Nigerian lawmakers summoned the Inspector General of Police over allegations of police brutality.
It is not an unofficial house arrest. If that thing is official, the government has just played the game not to announce it officially. But they called the collective of lawyers, of Maurice Kamto's lawyers, and announced to them that from hence, Maurice Kamto has been stopped from going out.
And the leader of a women's group condemns what she says is the abuse of the rights of Maurice Kamto, leader of Cameroon's main opposition party. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Are scheduled to vote to choose a new president Sunday. Incumbent President Alpha Conde seeks re-election following an amendment to the constitution which paved the way for him to seek a third term. Some Guineans say his re-election bid violates the tenets of democracy, but supporters of the president say the election will proceed as originally scheduled despite opposition boycott. Meanwhile, civil society groups are expressing concern about post-election violence. Foromo Frederick Lua is an attorney and a prominent Guinean human rights defender. He tells me that fears of possible violence after the election are legitimate.
What I can say is that there is currently confusion in Conakry, where there is talk of attempted mutiny in a military camp in Kindia, a town located 130 kilometers from Conakry. This morning, the entrance to downtown Conakry was blocked to the population, which creates fear and anxiety among the population.
Frederick, there's a suggestion that there's a mixed reaction about the upcoming election on Sunday. Some people want to go and vote. Others are saying the president has violated the constitution by amending it to run for a third term. As a civil society leader, what are your thoughts?
The fact that the president of the republic illegally changed the constitution to grant himself a second term has created a deep unease in the country. The FNDC, the civil society platform fighting against a third term of President Alpha Condé, has split. Some decided to go to the election as Selou Dalein of UFDG, while others refused to participate in the election as Sidya Touré of UFR. As far as I'm concerned, I think that enough front must be open against this project of confiscation of power by Alpha Condé and his clan. Participation in this election is one of the fronts without abandoning the other avenues. We are going to the election to impose alternation of power, and we ask the population to vote massively on October 18 to save Guinean democracy.
Some people fear there could be violence. Others are also saying it will be peaceful. But whatever it is, wouldn't President Conde be given another chance, just like in the referendum when a lot of people came out to vote, although it was reduced? He still managed to get his reforms, allowing him to run for a third term, as some people say.
Look, the process has been violent since the referendum was announced. And even the elections for the referendum were held in the midst of boycotts, protests, and violence throughout the country. Dozens of people have died with significant material damage. If these elections are not transparent and credible, which I doubt, there will be violence and the country risks being even more unstable.
Frederick, are you saying that you doubt that this Sunday's election will be free, fair, transparent, and credible? And what do you think the reaction of Guineans will be? What is your reaction to that?
What is regrettable is that the debates around these elections, instead of revolving around the achievements of Alpha Condé over the last 10 years, revolve around ethnicity and denigration. This is because the record of the outgoing president is mediocre. He is not ready to lose this election and will do everything to win it. Why? The polls are more in favor of the opposition. Finally, what may happen when the results are published is that the opposition may ask its supporters to take to the street and to demand the truth from the ballot box. Unfortunately, if this is the most likely scenario, there is a risk of violent repression.
Some people are speculating that opposition and civil society groups might not have the chance to freely call on their supporters to protest, which possibly could turn violent. Others are, however, saying that they have been marching and protesting and nothing has happened to them. So the country is experiencing a true democracy in spite of what the opposition has been saying. How do you respond to that?
No, there is no doubt that any opposition or protest that is not in the interest of the government has always been repressed. You know that since the announcement of the will of the President of the Republic to change the constitution to give himself a third term, there have been more than 50 people killed in demonstration without any justice. The democratic space has been narrowed, fundamental liberty have been confiscated, and repression have increased in intensity. This is the situation that we are currently facing in this country.
Foromo Frederick Lua is an attorney and a prominent human rights defender. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. The Nigerian House of Representatives has summoned the Inspector General of Police, Adamu Mohammed, to appear before a joint committee on justice, human rights and police affairs next week. The committee wants the Chief of Police to answer to allegations of extrajudicial killings and reports of the violation of the rights of citizens by the police. This after protesters demanded the disbandment of the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS, a police unit accused of carrying out violence against civilians. They are also demanding police reforms, vowing to continue the demonstrations until their demands are met. Sheung Bakari is the program's manager for Amnesty International Nigeria. He tells me the protesters appear to want the government to take immediate pragmatic steps to meet their demands.
One of the reasons why the protests are still continuing is that Nigerians are saying that they are tired of being governed by committees and panels and promises of reforms that lead to absolutely nothing. So this explains why there are still protests ongoing, because people are saying that we are tired of this summons. Past summons have led to nothing. We want to see concrete steps. We want to see genuine reforms. We want to see accountability within the police force. These are the things that matter to us. We don't want to see all of these cosmetic approaches of summoning people, setting up committees. All of these may not necessarily lead to what we want. What we want is immediate response to all of the issues around human rights violations by the Special Anti-Robbery Squad or by the officers of the now dissolved Special Anti-Robbery Squad. So that exactly is the reason why the protests are still continuing, irrespective of the steps that the government has been taking.
Most people are saying this is not the first time SARS has been disbanded, or this is not the first time protests have been carried out within the last 3 years or so. After this protest this year, what happens next?
We agree with the people who are saying that. And in Amnesty International, we have also said again and again that in the last 4 years alone, this government has promised reforms on four different occasions, and nothing has happened. In fact, one of the reasons why people believe that there may be no genuine reform is because in policing this protest alone, we have seen the high-handedness of the authorities. So this protest will come to an end at some point. But the real work of ensuring that there is genuine reform within the police. So when these protests are over, it is time for the authorities to sit down with the people that matter within the society, including the civil society organizations like Amnesty International, to say that these are the things that we have committed ourselves to do. These are some of the recommendations that we have seen in the reports that you have issued in the past. And now that we have seen this report, now that we know this recommendation, these are the steps that we are going to take to ensure that these recommendations are addressed. These are the promises that we have made to Nigerians. And this is the timeline. Hold us to account if we do not deliver within this timeline. And the asks are so easy. We have said, for example, bring perpetrators of human rights violations within SARS to justice.
From the intensity of this growing protest, what do you see as different? Because this is not the first time protests have been organized. This is not the first time demands have been made for reforms and disbandment of SARS. What is different this time from your observation?
What is different is that the people have gotten to a point where they can no longer stomach the continuous human rights violation by the police. The policing of this protest have been mismanaged by the authority. Amnesty put out an information to say that at least 10 people have died during the course of this protest. And what that implies is that people expect that because we have these complaints, you should at least start making efforts to address them. But if your efforts to address them also reveal the long-standing disregard for life, what that tells us is that we are not going to leave the streets until you have done what you need to do. And these protests have been different from previous protests because they have been so organic. The previous protests have been carried out by one or two groups here and there, the ENSAS movement group. The previous protests have been restricted to Lagos and Abuja, but now we have protests in very many cities across the country. So I think the organic nature of the protest itself, which is a product of the fact that people are already completely tired of these human rights violations, of these extrajudicial killings, of this wanton destruction of life by these SARS officials. I think that is why these protests have not only ceased, but are continuing. And we may not know how long these protests will continue, but one thing is that unless the authorities start doing the right thing, which is to bring perpetrators to book, to bring about genuine reform within the police force, we might have a situation on our hands where this protest will continue because these people we see on the street, they seem very determined and they want to pull through. And they keep saying that what they have gotten from the government so far is too little. They want more.
Seun Bakare is the program's manager for Amnesty International Nigeria. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara held his first rally in Bouake, the heartland of the opposition, Friday, as two leading opposition candidates urged their supporters to boycott the October vote while pushing for talks. For VOA, Katerina Hoya has the report from Ivory Coast's second largest city, Bouake.
Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara is pushing ahead on the campaign trail despite an opposition attempt to push for a dialogue by urging its supporters to boycott the October poll. Elections are going ahead, Ouattara told supporters at a rally in Bouake in central Ivory Coast on Friday. Ivorians will vote massively on Saturday, October 31st, Ouattara said. The president's appeal comes after two main opposition leaders, Henry Konan-Bedie and Afe Ngesan, on Friday renewed calls for their supporters to boycott the October 31st presidential elections in an attempt to get Ouattara's ruling party to address concerns over its legitimacy and electoral commission's neutrality. What is happening is not a presidential election, Nkesan, a former prime minister, told reporters in the commercial capital Abidjan. It's a coup, a hold-up, a sham. Henry Konabedi, the leader of the Democratic Party of Ivory Coast, widely seen as Ouattara's main contender, backed the call for boycott. Ivory Coast elections were set to be tense even before Ouattara announced he would seek a third term following the unexpected death of his preferred successor, Prime Minister Amadou Gonko Libeli. Ivory Coast is a two-term limit, but Ouattara's party has repeatedly said a new constitution adopted in 2016 allows him to run again.
The leader of the women's group of the main opposition party, the Cameroon Renaissance Movement, or CRM, is condemning what she says is the continued house arrest of the party's presidential candidate, Maurice Kamto. Mispa Awusum says it is unacceptable for the state security to continue to abuse Mr. Kamto's fundamental human rights with impunity. Her remarks come after the lawyers of the opposition leader filed a legal challenge to what the party says is the house arrest of its leader. This after the opposition leader organized a recent protest against the administration demanding electoral reforms and an end to the Anglophone crisis. But supporters of the government say the opposition leader has become a threat to national security. They also say the government needed to act to prevent the country from being plunged into violence and chaos. Mispa Awusum tells me the activities of the opposition party will continue in spite of the ongoing challenges it faces.
As the national women's president of the CRM, it's embarrassing and a shock to us, to me in particular, to see that my boss has been held hostage under house arrest. People might describe it house arrest. They are right to describe it as house arrest because it has all the features of a house arrest. And be it what, if they don't want to make it official, but they have put all the elements, they have shown all what it takes, all characteristics of a house arrest, like constant police and gendarme patrol around his house. You see the military cars well blocked in front of his gate, not allow him to go out. And not being enough, the collective of lawyers, they were convoked by the national security and the state defense of the gendarmerie, where they were told that President-elect Maurice Kamto is not allowed to go out of his house. What is the essence of that? That means he has been stopped from going out to carry out his normal activities as a citizen. That is officially a house arrest. They are unacceptable.
Critics of Professor Kamto are of the view that he has become a threat to national security, and his plans to organize street protests against the government undermines the territorial integrity of Cameroon and so has to be contained to prevent the country from plunging into chaos and anarchy. How do you respond to that?
Peter, one thing I want to let these critics they know is that they are criticism saying that he is a threat to national order and national peace. It's a false. It's falsehood. That's a big lie. It's a big lie. Let them, for instance, tell us where either Kamto or the sympathizers or the militants or the people of Cameroonians in any of the protests that we are doing have destroyed any state property or even private property anywhere. We have disturbed anybody from going out to do his or her job or her business. But I want to say rather, the regime of Mr. Biya, they are a threat to national order and security to the people of Cameroon. Yes, yes, because look at the ongoing crisis in the Northwest and Southwest. They are making those criticisms because of one reason or the other. Might be they are aiming or eyeing for a job from the government, or they are merely protecting or preventing themselves from losing the job where they are holding presently. That's why they give all the critics.
Does that mean that plans by your party and other opposition parties to continue protesting every Tuesday is still on course, despite your presidential candidate not being there to support or lead the protest?
The plans are still on course, Peter, but if subsequently, as we see how things are evolving, if we feel that we need to do some adjustment, then the coalition is going to sit again in another meeting and do the adjustments. I think that the Cameroonian people should not just say that if the leader, Maurice Kamto, is not there and they will not take their destinies into your hands. No, then we should be making a mistake, because His Excellency Maurice Kamto has done the job. He has done the greatest job that the Cameroonian people should now take their destinies in their hands, whether he's there or not.
Ms. Ba, what is your party, or for that matter, the women's group in your party, doing about what a lot of Cameroonians are saying is the unofficial house arrest of your presidential candidate, Maurice Kamto?
Yeah, we are working. It's not like we are not doing anything. We are doing a lot of things, and I want to say that those ones remain to us as part of our strategies. We don't want to go in any confrontation with the police, because, like I've always said, that we are a very peaceful party. We are peaceful Cameroonian women, and we want justice. We want democracy. We want change. We want a stop to the molestation and harassment of women that have been going on. We are standing on the same position. We are still working on the ground. We are doing some work. We are not folding our hands and sitting. So we want to tell the government that we women, we are calling on them to take action to liberate our president. Cameroonian people, Cameroonian women, I am talking as the voice of the Cameroonian women, that it is not an unofficial house arrest. If that thing is official, the government has just played the game not to announce it officially, but they called the collective of lawyers, of Maurice Kamto's lawyers, and announced to them that from hence, Maurice Kamto has been stopped from going out.
Ms. Pa Awusum is the leader of the women's group of the main opposition party, the Cameroon Renaissance Movement, or CRM. She spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. A group of 153 vulnerable African refugees and asylum seekers were flown out of Libya to Niger recently on a plane chartered by the UN Refugee Agency. This is the first life-saving evacuation from Libya in 7 months after the operation was suspended because of COVID-19. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Among the passengers on Monday's flight are nationals of Eritrea, Somalia, Sudan, and South Sudan, including 16 families and 15 children under age 18. Many of the children are unaccompanied or separated from their parents. The UN Refugee Agency reports most of the evacuees had been living in the Libyan capital, Tripoli. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mehecic says virtually all had been arbitrarily detained and forced to live under appalling conditions for some period of time in one of Libya's notoriously bad detention centers.
The resumption of evacuation flights is especially important now, given the volatile situation in Libya, the rapid spread of the coronavirus and its health, as well as socioeconomic impact on refugees and asylum seekers, who have found it increasingly difficult to support themselves and their families.
COVID-19 cases continue to rise in Libya. The World Health Organization reports more than 46,600 cases, including 681 deaths. As a precautionary measure, all passengers tested negative prior to departure. The UNHCR says they will remain in quarantine in Niger for 2 weeks and then tested again to make sure they are free of the virus. Mehecic says more than 3,400 migrants and asylum seekers are held in government-run detention centers in Libya. He tells VOA the UNHCR is advocating for their release, as many are at risk of serious abuse.
We also advocate for the release of people who might be held in any other possible such facilities, and we know that there are many, given the volatile and fragmented situation inside Libya, that there are probably many other detention centers that we do not also know of.
This is the second evacuation flight this year. The previous one was in February, before the operation was suspended because of COVID-19. The UNHCR has evacuated a total of 501 refugees from Libya this year, including 221 who have been resettled to Europe. Mehecic says the agency is hoping to help more vulnerable people leave Libya. However, he notes much of this is contingent on finding resettlement places and other durable solutions for refugees and asylum seekers who have fled violence and persecution and cannot go home. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Zambian ambassador to Turkey is coming under criticism after announcing plans to hold a national day of prayer, fasting, repentance, and reconciliation Sunday. Critics say the program is a sharp deviation from the core mission of the Zambian embassy in Turkey. They contend the program is a diplomatic faux pas since Islam is the largest religion in Turkey. They also argue that officials at the embassy should have been aware that although Zambia is a Christian nation, the embassy represents other citizens from different faiths. But Joseph Chilenji, the Zambian top envoy to Turkey, denies the program violates the embassy's core mission. He says Zambians want to seek God's intervention for sustained national unity, peace, and prosperity during the program. To learn more, I reach Ambassador Joseph Chilenji in the Turkish capital, Ankara.
We, the people of Zambia, acknowledge the supremacy of God Almighty, declare the Republic of Zambia a Christian nation, while upholding persons' rights to freedom of conscience, belief, and religion. And so that significance, therefore, is that it is against this background and to reinforce that declaration of Zambia as a Christian nation, His Excellency President Edgar Chagwa Lungu, President of the Republic of Zambia, who is also a devout Christian himself, in 2018 declared October 18th as a national day of prayer, fasting, repentance and reconciliation, as a sign of the country's relevance or relevance to God and acknowledgement of His sovereignty. So this day is significant to this country, to our country, and it enables us Zambians to praise God for milestones that the country has recorded, and also look at successes called as well as to seek God's divine intervention on the challenges that the nation may be facing. So that's the significance of this day.
Ambassador Chilenji, what's the theme for this national breakfast, if I may ask you?
The national day will be observed under the theme Zambia seeks God's intervention for sustained national unity, peace and prosperity, inspired by Isaiah 43, verses 2 to 3. And so it's a significant theme because we are giving the country the inspiration from our leadership that despite the challenges that the country and the world is facing, with God's guidance, we shall overcome.
What do you seek, or what does the embassy seek to achieve with this observation or this program?
Just for your information, in the last 24 hours, four embassies will come together at the same time to go host this National Day of Prayer. The Embassy of the Republic of Zambia in Turkey, the Embassy of the Republic of Zambia and Permanent Mission to the United Nations in Geneva, the Embassy of the Republic of Zambia to France in Paris and to WTO and the UNESCO, and the Embassy of the Republic of Zambia in Belgium and to the European Union. So four embassies will be coming together because we feel that Zambia as a country must reign on that Sunday, that we must be at every space of the world and prepare God's way for the satisfaction and deliverance of mankind, including ourselves.
Some Zambians that I spoke with who saw the flyer about the National Prayer Breakfast observation at the embassy in Turkey say that this is not what a top envoy and the embassy should be doing. They argue that this is a deviation from the core duty of the mission. What do you say to that?
You have cultural diplomacy, it's not a deviation. Now we have digital diplomacy, it's not a deviation, and therefore this is religious diplomacy. And so it's part of our diplomatic function, and it's part of a diplomatic function of any distinguished diplomatic institution. We are not deviating at all. It is part of our responsibility to ensure that religion forms part of international diplomacy as well, so as to underscore it as a very important aspect of our life.
What has been the response of Zambians in Turkey following your invitation for the observation of this national prayer observation in Turkey?
The response has been overwhelming. We never even expected it. That's why I'm saying that while we were thinking it was going to be a national day of prayer for Zambians, I wish to mention that we have received responses from so many Turkish communities, both in Turkey and without Turkey. We have received so much interest from other countries of extra jurisdiction, which are served by Turkey, Jordan, Azerbaijan, Georgia, and North Macedonia, have also come in on board to participate. But most importantly, this is to mention that we have also received a very important and significant message of encouragement from the Bishop of the Church of England, which we shall deliver to the community on that particular day.
Joseph Chilenji is the Zambian ambassador to Turkey. He spoke with me from Turkey's capital, Ankara. The executive director of Uganda's Professional Drivers Network says the group has evidence showing that some long-distance truck drivers have been paying bribes to get negative COVID-19 tests. Omongo Ndugu, who is also the vice chairperson of the Uganda Long Distance and Heavy Truck Drivers Association, says drivers and their associates pay between $14 to $40 as bribes to get a negative certificate. The drivers are required to each have a negative coronavirus certificate before they can cross the border into any East African country. Mr. Ndugu said the bribes are undermining efforts to limit the spread of the coronavirus in the East African region. To learn more about his organization's concerns, I reached Omongo Ndugu, the executive director of Uganda Professional Drivers Network and the vice chairperson of the Uganda Long Distance and Heavy Truck Drivers Association.
It is true that we have reported incidences among our drivers of drivers getting either COVID negative results or actually using bribe to cross the border without being tested, which has also been reported at the Legu border, the border of Sudan and Uganda. For the Busia and Malaba, it arose out of the result of delayed testing from the Kenyan side, that for last week there was a jam stretching for over 65 kilometers into Kenya. And the drivers were left with no option other than to respond to brokers who approached them and took bribes. And in a short while, they were shocked that they were able to receive negative results on their phone. And this, for us as an entity that is supporting government response, is surely very absurd, because it takes us back to where we could have started from in trying to mitigate the spread of COVID-19.
What is your organization doing, partnering with the government to try to resolve this problem?
Our organization has been so instrumental in complementing government work, especially the Ministry of Health, in terms of risk communication, surveillance, and case management. However, today, because I sit in the point of entry meeting at the Ministry of Health, I also went ahead to explain to the team there, who were equally concerned that this dents the image of the ministry and the people who are working at the border points. In the same vein, we said collectively, we need to investigate whether the problem could be coming from the laboratories that maybe results are being swapped. Then also, secondly, to try and check with our security features for the messages, because there could be a possibility that some people who are just good in manipulating the telephone could be sending one message to multiple telephones, so they are able to collect bribes and send a message to your phone.
What do you say to those who are of the opinion that the government should have instituted a policy or a mechanism that would make it effective to ease the traffic congestion, and by so doing, undermining this payment or bribery that this doesn't occur? What do you make of it?
That opinion is okay. However, it is a bit conservative, because you first have to understand the reason the drivers are paying these bribes is, one, the delay. So you would have solved that issue. But you would have not solved the challenge of a truck driver that feels less engaged when decisions of government is taken. You have not solved the challenge of disparity in cross-border policies, where when you go to Kenya or you go to Congo, you're not paying for these fees. When you go to Sudan, but when you come to Uganda, you have to part with $65. So I think it would be a short-term solution, because now, much as somebody has to test from maybe Kampala or from Nairobi or where before reaching the border, still, I highly believe, because the majority voice out there is, one, the 14 days time given for testing is very small, and if you consider most of the drivers in Uganda are freelance, in that they don't have formalized jobs. So they are only given 300 or 400,000 Uganda shillings to go for a trip. For me, those are my concerns.
What do you think is the best way forward to resolve this problem?
Let us look at establishing as many testing centers across the country as possible, so that drivers are able to test from wherever they can test from before reaching the border. But then linked to that, then eradicate the border point testing for truck drivers. Engage the drivers and tell them, you know, now you don't have to go and test from the border, and we are no longer having a testing facility at the border. Then let's all go to the border when we are only going to cross. Check on the security measures of ensuring that somebody cannot swap these results or duplicate messages and send. But the other bigger issue is the person, because we have within the people who are working, I know the ministry is highly stretched. So most of the people who are working with the ministry are volunteers. So many of these people have chances or can end up taking bribes, because these are like part-time jobs to them. They will have to have a life after COVID. So with those, include the clients, have the drivers involved at every decision-making point. But also, I would request that another solution is extending the test period to at least 2 or 3 months. 14 days, we shall remain with the issue of bribery, because it is highly expensive.
Omongo Ndugu is the executive director of Uganda's Professional Drivers Network and the vice chairperson of the Uganda Long Distance and Heavy Truck Drivers Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Oga fluffy senti sinan merudi tandale. Meshindwa kulipa bima, nimeuza madale. Radio nyimbo mezima, TV ndio hatare. Meneja umebaki jina, nitakia tatale. Ole shabiki zangu, waloni sifu kwa maneno matamu. Leo mati zangu, ni mitusi tu kwa Instagramu. Kimwa na statangu, eti naya nifamu. Hata mwona ize kimpigia, ananifukia kama salamu. Na magazeti nyumbani kwa kuku sabani, sunajuaga. Utasikia tafarani timoni kwa zari. Kwa jibu sinaga. Kama naiona michambo ya matemwa
zamani tunapitia na yosema yana maana sababu kuna anejua kesho anepanga ni rabana ila mificha ni confidential ukisaiomba sana mume unisije kwa kichekesho maana rafiki wa jana ndio adui mkubwa kesho. Katama kadiriki atajapo kuniposti pindisho zimekwama na nikipata si jasi ni mikosi oh jasi mezama mwana ni msuru baba kama na mwana mwanangu roho yangu tifada ngote anakwenda na mamangu kwa chaka kikwetu na fukuzwa toke usilie sanangu mwani yangu chikaze usichoke wenda kesho za mwana yangu nitavuma tena Timoni kwa zari amemwaga yeye na vinyeni hivyo nyonge tabia ya kujibu sina anga
Yeah. as we all know.
Oh. Was
Sina mengi, ila naweza sema, asante kwa mwenyezi mungu. Na muomba sana, kwenye ndoa tupe nguvu.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a ripened fruit does not cling to the vine. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.